The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa Trade Management Online. Now's the time to speak to Absa Corporate and Investment Banking about all your import and export finance needs. Absa is a registered FSP. Good evening and welcome to The Money Show. Lots to come this evening on the show, whether you can force your staff to have a COVID vaccine, under what circumstances you can demand that your staff have a vaccine, and what happens if they refuse, if they simply don't have a vaccine for whatever reason, whether it be an allergy-related issue, whatever the case is, if they pose a risk in your workplace, what is your right then as an employer? Then later on, what you need to be careful of when it comes to this huge deluge we're seeing in positive economic data. Wherever you look, there's a number going in the right direction. We'll talk about the hospitals crisis. It's come to a head in Gauteng. I will talk to Dr. Richard Friedland just after 7 o'clock this evening. Richard is the Chief Executive Officer at Netcare. And Netcare, of course, is one of the private hospitals that has been at the forefront of the battle against COVID-19. And as the crisis rises and the toll of cases rises, particularly in Gauteng, but also in other parts of the country, we're seeing hospitals beginning to creak at the seams. Toby Shapshak, all things tech, at what point can you justify upgrading a perfectly good television set? I know it's 15 years old, but it still works. Why do you need to upgrade it? We'll talk to Toby about that. He is the publisher of Stuff magazine. And then Colin Coleman this evening at 7:30. I saw on LinkedIn today that he spent the day today with his 95-year-old dad. Happy birthday, Dad Coleman, who served, I didn't know this, in Nelson Mandela's cabinet. That's interesting. Colin Coleman himself, an activist at the end of the 1980s and into the 1990s, and was bereft last week, as many were, by the death of Jabu Mabuza, the latest high-profile person to succumb to COVID-19 from the business sector. We'll talk to him about that. We'll talk to him about the role that Jabu played, but also the role that he plays into the future, too, as somebody who's deeply embedded in South Africa's political economy. All of that is coming up this evening here on The Money Show.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Wherever you look, there are positive economic data points. And I don't mean to poo-poo any single one of those positive economic data points, because they're all considerably better than the very worst forecasts that were being made this time last year. We would come out of the hardest of the hard lockdowns this time last year, and we were headed for double-digit declines in contraction. The economy was going to contract by double digits, and it was all going to be so much worse. But confidence is up amongst businesses. It's up amongst consumers. The data is showing that on average we're better off than a year ago. Growth is going to beat expectations thanks to a boom, and particularly in commodity prices. We should be feeling a whole lot better about the future than we are. But here's the fundamental problem. Positive economic numbers don't necessarily mean the economy is improving. To explain it to us, Tsepo Maloe, who is economist at the Bureau for Economic Research in Stellenbosch. And Tsepo, welcome to The Money Show this evening. Why, if all the numbers are going better than we feared they would be, is the economy not improving?
Thank you very much for having me on the show, Bruce, and a very good evening to your listeners. I think at the very heart of it is that a lot of the figures we've seen coming out in this quarter and the previous months is that they're coming off from a very low base, right? As you rightfully point out, that you'd recall that South Africa introduced its lockdown during the beginning of April in 2020, where the sale of non-essential items, be it semi-durable goods or durable goods, were prohibited. So much of these results we also seen here in terms of the confidence of retailers is on the back of a very low base. But beyond that, I think we're beginning to see a bit of a bounce back in terms of the confidence levels, particularly of high-income earners. as you would know that, yeah, they fueled by a number of factors. Among these is the mere fact that interest rates remain significantly low in South Africa. You've got a stock market that has been trending upwards. But I think they're also excited about the better than expected economic recovery that they see globally and locally. So, yeah, those are among the factors why we're starting to see a bounce back in terms of confidence. But in all, it's a matter of a bounce back, that technical bounce back effect that we're seeing from Q2 given the strict lockdown.
Now, technical bounce back effect. Okay, if I'm going to challenge that slightly, we are still, no matter what happens this year, the economy will be smaller at the end of this year than it was at the end of 2019. And that is, with all of this positive economic data, it doesn't mean that we're not recovering. It's a positive sign, which is good, but we're just not recovering as fast as other parts of the world, which many of which will be back, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere, the United States and others, will be back to 2019 levels by the end of this year. I mean, they've rebounded strongly.
Most definitely. I think one needs to make a distinction between the level of GDP and growth and the growth rates therein. You're quite right. In terms of level terms, South Africa will not be at pre-pandemic levels anytime soon. And part of the reason is that, as you would recall, that South Africa entered this pandemic already in a recession. We already had a weak labor market. And what the COVID-19 pandemic did is simply make our problems worse. And we've been calling for a lot of structural economic reforms in order to ensure that we start to make sure that the South African economy grows in the future. In the absence of any reform, you and I will still have this conversation the same here and the same time next year.
We are seeing some forecasts, though, that suggest that we will be back to 2019 levels far more quickly than had been anticipated, provided the wheels don't come off on what's happening currently. And yes, they're at risk of doing so, courtesy of what's going on with COVID at the moment and depending on how government responds to that. You know, the fact is things are better than we feared, but things are nowhere nearly as good as they could be if we took more proactive steps in terms of reforming the economy to a point where Tito Mboweni, even the guy who was the architect of the original labor laws, has been to say, hold on a second, perhaps we need to be thinking about how we run the place differently.
Certainly, and hence I made reference to the structural reforms, right? So in sectors such as the communications sector, for example, there are a number of low-hanging fruits, for instance. The auctioning and the successful implementation of spectrum is one of the low-hanging fruits that we should be taking advantage of. Likewise, in the renewable energy space, in terms of alternative energy sources, those are the two industries where we can unlock much of the growth that's needed in the sector. But fundamentally, there's a bigger need to have the structural economic reforms in as far as the ease in which South Africa enables businesses to operate in South Africa. So often I speak to investors who refer to the high cost of doing business or the difficulty in doing business in South Africa. And as a result, this does not lead in them expanding their fixed investment in the country.
Yeah, I mean, I see Burger King and Grand Parade Investments and the buyers, the people who want to buy Burger King, are now talking very actively to the Competition Commission in terms of their ruling, for example, of the refusal to allow the sale of Burger King to an American-controlled private equity group because they didn't have an appropriate BE status. I mean, it's that sort of ruling that really does send, it's like an anaphylactic shock to somebody who's allergic to peanuts being given a bowl of peanuts for breakfast.
You couldn't have put it more promptly, Bruce. Yeah. And this is across the board. Mind you, we are not saying that I think the objective of transformation of the economy and the growth of South African economy are not mutually exclusive objectives. I think we still need to lose sight. We must not lose sight of that objective. But in the end, ultimately, we do require the jobs that are so required in our economy. We need to make sure that we boost productivity so that the South African economy can start growing again. Because in the absence of those reforms in that space, as I said, that the future looks bleak for the South African economy.
How the? I mean, again, we keep talking about policy reform, and I'm yawning at the prospect of further discussion on policy reform. But it is what is at the very, very heart of the problem. We're going to talk to Ayabonga Tawe later on, and he's written a fabulous new book in which he spells this out in great detail. He's a developmental economist. I'm sure you know him, and you may have seen his book. And it's just this huge disconnect between predominantly black South Africans and predominantly white South Africans, many of whom continue to benefit from an economic structure almost at the expense of those who are left on the periphery.
Indeed, we do know that the poverty, inequality and the unemployment trends in South Africa, there's a distinction on the basis of race, on the basis of gender, even on the basis of age. And hence, earlier on, I made the point about not losing the transformation aspect of growing the economy. It's one thing to grow the economy, but the question is it inclusive growth in a manner that allows a lot of participants to participate in the economy in a manner that allows them to improve their livelihoods and therefore by implication will have inclusive growth and change the lives of South Africans. If those objectives are not clear and in our pursuit of policy, of reforms, of implementation of whatever programs we have, if we do not if we are not mindful of those objectives, then my grandkids or even my great-great-grandkids will be having the same conversation, Bruce.
I mean, yeah, here's the thing. I mean, we started off by saying, you know, just because the economic data is pointing in the right direction doesn't mean that anything is actually getting better for the vast majority of people. And I think that brings it full circle to the point where we say, yes, there is a recovery happening. Yes, it's good news. Yes, there, you know, things are not as bad as we feared. The problem is most people are being left out of the recovery.
Indeed, and if you look at the nature of the recovery, and earlier on you made reference to the US, to the UK, remember that much of the recovery they also seen here was on the back of the massive fiscal stimulus that they had from their government. And that's why you saw that huge V-shaped recovery in most of those jurisdictions. In the South African case, where we don't have any fiscal room to maneuver, certainly the disparities in as far as economic growth and recovery will be seen there. And hence, at this point in time, beyond the stimulus from these countries, it would have been a different picture compared to what you see in terms of economic data today.
Thank you very much to Tsepo Moloi, who is economist at the Bureau for Economic Research based in Stellenbosch.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
And on to markets today. The rest of the world seemed to have a much better day than we did. Our currencies come under quite a lot of pressure in the last week or so, and we've also seen prices of shares fall quite sharply. Let's get the helicopter view from Peter Brook, who is a portfolio manager with the Old Mutual Investment Group. He's on the line to us from Cape Town this evening. What do you make of the last week or so in markets, JSE versus the rest of the world, Peter Brook?
It's actually been really interesting, Bruce, because South Africa's underperformance has been very marked. So if you look at months to date, for instance, the JSE is the second worst performing market that we look at in terms of, and that's partially some of it, we've had a weak currency, but we've also had weak shares. And so some of those gold shares are off 20-odd%. Even our banks are off a chunk. So it's been very weak. And I think there's a couple of different drivers behind that.
I mean, it's not just then about the United States and the fear of inflation and the U.S. Fed turning fairly hawkish last week, in which it started actually talking up the possibility of raising interest rates at least by the end of 2023, although the market is anticipating it'll have to do it a lot sooner than that.
Look, I think the Federal Reserve controls global liquidity, so anything they say is hugely important and was definitely a factor. But I think there are some other factors. So one of the things that I think is important is the Chinese have been very aggressive in terms of trying to get commodity prices down and releasing some of their reserves. And you've seen, for instance, the copper price is down 8%, but something like rhodium is down a big chunk. So I think you've got a combination of a little bit of speculative froth being pushed out of the market by the Fed. You've got the Chinese pushing on materials. And then the truth is, South Africa has been really phenomenally strong. I mean, we're talking about a rand that was knocking around, I think, 1325. So,
yep.
you know, everyone was going, oh, if it breaks through 14, that's really strong. So we're at 14.30 today. Some of it was just we had got a little bit ahead of ourselves. And I'm looking at, for instance, the banks. You know, the bank shares are down 7-8% month to date. But if I just look at the 1 month, they're all up. So it's really strong, then weak. So I think you put those three factors together. South Africa ran a little bit ahead of itself, very strong rand. Fed taking some froth out of market, and the Chinese putting some pressure on commodity speculators, and that was ripe for our market to come back. But remember, longer term, it's going to be driven by what actually happens to the earnings. What's the supply and demand for these underlying commodities? And I still think global growth is going to be good.
And that's positive because it does indicate that then that demand remains strong. And if demand remains strong, then we carry on with our exports. The U.S. Treasury rate, though, is the important number, certainly in the short term, because that tells you what markets are anticipating will happen with the future of interest rates. And at one stage, I think it was last year, we were seeing U.S. Treasuries get to 3%. Where are they sitting now?
I'll just look that up while I'm talking to you. But I know, for instance, that the U.S. 30-year, which is your really long-dated money, has come down by about 25 basis points. That's a huge, huge move for the basic global cost of capital. And this is what's also been quite interesting, is because what had happened is the market is pricing in inflation. And so you've got inflation expectations, the Fed's going to allow things to run too hot. You have the Fed meeting saying, well, hang on a minute, we might not let things run too hot. And so that immediately shifted the perceptions around short rates. But the interesting element of that is that long bonds, the price went up and the yield fell. In other words, your long-term cost of capital decreased. And what that's telling us is that the market is saying, okay, we trust the Fed is not going to let inflation get out of control.
Okay, so all that actually net positive. I mean, when we look at it, it's a bit uncomfortable in the short term because it disrupts the comfort of rising markets and strengthening currency. And it's just, this is a market. Things go up, things go down. Talk to me about the results out of Naspers and Prosus. Tencent is still very much the epicenter of the money tree there.
That's very true, and that remains the case. But actually, the results were very interesting in terms of their e-commerce businesses, where they had really good results. We're actually underweight in our funds within the Naspers Prosus complex, but I think it's only fair to say these are good numbers. Basically, they got more customers using their platforms, and they had to spend less money to get there. And very simply, I think that's an effect of the COVID lockdown, where people increase their utilization of e-commerce. So things like iFood in Brazil did really well. More recently, as some of their countries have opened up, the second-hand market for cars have helped some of their classified verticals. So I would say generally actually a pretty good result from Prosus.
But the market, individual investors, big institutional investors, are quite grumpy with Prosus and Naspers management. It is all about transparency. It's all about this control structure of Naspers and this attempt by Prosus to do a really complicated deal in order to get more Naspers shares in Prosus over time. And it's just, there is, I don't know, is it a bad smell? Is it an overhang? What is it? The key reason why you are underweight these companies now, which have been the bellwethers of this market now for a decade or more?
So Nilesh Hanshi, our analyst who covers the stock, put out a very nice opinion piece on this in Business Day, laying out the pros and cons. The truth is, what they're doing to unlock the discount adds to complexity. I can completely understand why they're doing it, but it doesn't necessarily solve the discount problem. But the real reason we were more cautious was really around the global value growth rotation, and particularly the risks around big tech and specifically China. So what's happened as a result of their competition commission and their competition policy is all of the Chinese e-commerce companies have said, well, there's lots of competition and we're going to prove it to you by investing very hard, which means that their profits are not going to be great in the coming year or so. For assets that were highly priced, that leaves them vulnerable. So you said it at the beginning of our conversation, Tencent is the dog and everything else is the tail. So we were really focusing on Tencent and the pressure there as opposed to the other elements.
Thank you, Peter Brook. He's a portfolio manager at the Old Mutual Investment Group. All the lighters from Cape Town.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Well, today we're talking and giving your brand a head start in the world of performance marketing with IdeaHive. Want to elevate your brand? Visit ideahive.co.za.
At IdeaHive, we have adopted a unique and insightful way of brand storytelling. Our strategies, campaigns, and creativity are informed and backed by real-time marketing research tools. Through seamless alliance between humans and AI, our solutions evoke brand love and loyalty from your audience. Most importantly, our solutions will seek to elevate your brand while giving you a return on investment. Our services include content creation, deployment and monitoring, data analytics, consumer insights, UX, UI, PR, digital marketing, MarTech, and more. IdeaHive, elevate your brand today.
Today's We're Talking brought to you by IdeaHive, an independent data-driven performance marketing agency which uses data, insights and technology to connect your brand with the right audience. Visit ideahive.co.za for more.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield brought to you by Absa Trade Management Online. Transact securely online with Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Absa is a registered FSP.
Welcome to The Money Show. On the next Money Show, Chantal Marks, the Head of Investment and Research at FNB, is this week's head teacher in our investment school. She'll be looking at how inflation is affecting your investments. We'll also have our regular trip around the Africa business sector with our Africa Business Report and Andy Rice, Heroes and Zeros from the World of Advertising. Always fun on a Tuesday.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
This is The Money Show. In a moment, can you force your staff to have a vaccine? We'll talk to Patrick Deal, the labor law expert from Deal Attorneys, on the line to us from KZN. And then, when is it a good time to get a new television? We're talking from an economic perspective, not just because you think it's pretty not to have a frame around the screen. Toby Shapshak, I'm not sure he has that perspective. He just likes all things that are shiny and new. But we'll talk about it. We'll talk about it this evening here on The Money Show. Well, new rules and regulations as it comes to dealing with COVID-19 in the workplace, of course. And I'm wondering whether or not new regulations will enable you as an employer or you as a manager or you as a staff member to insist that your colleagues are vaccinated and refuse to come to work unless everybody is, or enforce the principle that everybody needs to be vaccinated. Patrick Deal, labor law expert from Deal Attorneys, on the line to us from KZN. Broad brushstrokes, if you would, Patrick Deal. What is the newest regulation as it comes to vaccines and the workplace?
Hello, Bruce. Good evening to you and good evening to your listeners. Well, the newest regulations say that all employers, and that means all employers, must implement undertake a risk assessment of the risks of the people being infected in their workforce of the virus. And the risk assessment is done as in terms of the normal occupational health and safety regulations. But in this case, it's specifically aimed at the risk of employees contracting COVID. And they must assess the nature of their workplace, what those risks are. And once they have identified risks, they must then put a plan into place to determine which particular employees, because of the nature of their workplace, may be at more risk than others.
Now, Patrick, I'm not too sure if you have a hand over a mouthpiece or something like that. If I could ask you just to hold your phone slightly differently, we may have a bit more luck in terms of signal. But, I mean, what qualifies anybody in the workplace, frankly, without any high level of scientific expertise in the face of the rapidly evolving virus where we're seeing the Delta variant causing rising infection rates across the world? I mean, surely one needs a high level of expertise to make that sort of risk assessment in the workplace.
Well, one would imagine so. I think you're quite right about it. But I think in terms of the basic protocols that could form a basis for determining whether there's a risk, like social distancing. Are employees working in a place which is crowded or uncrowded? Is a person working in a taxi or in a train which is separate from other people or going down a mine amongst a whole lot of people? That kind of thing. So it could, at one level, be quite a common sense approach as to whether people are working close to each other and therefore whether they are likely to be infected by others and so on. And so I think at that level, applying the basic protocols as opposed to really scientific levels could be a way of trying to assess whether there is a risk or not. That sounds simplistic, but I don't think that level, the scientific level, can be any more than that can be expected of the average employer.
Okay, so if I, as an employer, determine that there is a risk of transmission in my workplace, and I come up with a plan and I say, right, so that means that everybody in the workplace must have a vaccine. Does that then oblige all of my employees to have that vaccine if I have deemed that there is a risk of transmission in the workplace?
Yes, it would. And that, of course, assumes that the risk assessment is reasonable, it's logical, and it's persuasive. And if you do have that, then and the employer says, you must get it, and people then refuse to take the vaccine, well, then the employer can do one of two things. They can put them through a process of trying to persuade them otherwise. Secondly, to try and accommodate them in some way if they don't take the vaccine, to avoid them risking other people's health. And if that doesn't work, if there's no way of accommodating them, they can actually take steps to terminate their services for operational reasons. And that's the one way. Another way could be to do it on incapacity grounds, that that employee is making himself incapable of performing the work because of the risk of infecting others, and ending the same result after counseling and after efforts to accommodate. So either way, if you have a mandatory vaccination policy, which is reasonable, you can terminate all employees, with particular employees who decline to and who refuse. And I think, and that is implicit in the new directive or direction that was put out in the government gazette on the 11th of June. It doesn't specifically say what would happen if an employee were to dismiss after having put a plan together after an assessment. So I think the door is open to use normal labor law practices and labor law protocols to apply it in the COVID scenario, but using the retrenchment process and possibly the incapacity procedure.
It's so interesting. Thank you, Patrick Deal. Not a great phone line to us in KZN this evening, but I think the story explained well. Labour law expert from Deal Attorneys, Patrick Deal, this evening. Yes, you can be forced, provided it's reasonable. And again, who's going to assess the reasonableness there? And are you going to have the energy and the money to fight the fight if your boss says you need to have a vaccine and you, for whatever reason, decide not to have the vaccine? Will you be in the mood to fight it, or are you going to be compliant and simply have the bloomin' vaccine? De-risk yourself and de-risk those around you. Otherwise, your employer, it would seem, according to these new regulations, has every good reason to get rid of you if, for whatever reason, including incapacity, you're incapable of doing the job because you're going to pose a risk to yourself and others, you need to be removed from that workspace. I think it's a fundamental shift in South Africa's labor regulations.
702.
Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
Welcome to The Money Show on this Monday evening. Toby Shapshak with us now. Just this weekend, my nine-year-old, who's yet to work out that his father's a cheapskate, an unreformable cheapskate, says, Dad, when are we getting a new TV? So I turn to the TV and I say to him, there's nothing wrong with the TV. It's got a picture in color. There is sound. They even happened at the same time. But he's seeing lots of new tech being advertised, and he likes the look of the new tech. And people are always looking for an excuse, Toby Shapshak, to upgrade their tech. I, however, am more old school. I like to use stuff till it breaks and cannot be repaired. But if you are looking for an excuse, I suppose the British and Irish Lions are coming. So therefore, maybe we need a new TV so that we can see the nicks, bumps and scratches in higher definition or some such.
Yes, well, for me, this is a matter of national importance. I love only one sport, Bruce, and that is rugby. And in fact, my career as a rugby writer began with the last Lions tour. In fact, the very first Lions tour in 97. That was my the first time I ever covered a rugby match. So I have a particular affection for it. I also am part of that statistic that upgrades whenever there's a big sporting event. A lot of people do it for the Olympics, or the Soccer World Cup, or the Cricket World Cup. I have worked on, I've been doing it for the Rugby World Cup. And in this instance, there's a nice, like, you know, midway between World Cup Boost, which is the Lions Tour. So I've been looking at all the new TV technology, and I have to say that Samsung's new Neo QLED is awesome. We had one of these monster televisions in our stuff studios, and I was forced, obviously, to, you know, look at a lot of stuff and look at this unbelievable 8K screen. We had the very top-end one, which costs 185,000 Rand, but you get very reasonably priced 55 and 65-inch screens, and the 8K resolution is frankly gobsmacking. So how do you get 8K? Well, remember that HD, full HD, is called 1080p. 4K is four times that. 8K is eight times full HD. And even if you don't have that full signal, the TV has some very smart software and AI algorithms that upscale the quality of the image. So,
okay, now just you've just used all of the jargon from the back of the TV box, which is very impressive, and it shows that you can read it. But now you've got to explain it.
It's terrible. I spoke jargon on the radio. I'm going to have to fire myself tomorrow.
You are, I'm afraid.
What has happened to me?
When you go into the TV shop, the place where the televisions are sold, you get all these wonderful images, and these images look beautiful. And then you say to the salesman, so is it going to look like that at home? And says, well, how strong is your signal? And you go, well, my signal is the signal. He says, oh, well, it won't look like that because we've got it directly plugged into some server somewhere that you won't have access to. So it's not going to look like that. So what's the point?
So that is a bit of a sleight of hand in store sale. But I can tell you that I have a 4K OLED television at the moment from LG, which is spectacular, and it does upscale it. So, you know, I watch a lot of DSTV. That's where I watch my rugby. Netflix in 4K, Showmax, Amazon Prime, all of them look fantastic, you know. So that's part of the genius of the television, and that it knows that all of the capacity, all the movies in 8K aren't there yet. They're certainly coming along. But it kind of gives you a good enough experience. Look, to watch the World Cup, you're going to need a DSTV decoder. Or actually, if you don't have one, you can use an app. When we moved into our house 7 years ago, part of my big idea was that I'd put a television outside on the patio, and I connected an extra view decoder to it so that I could sit outside and watch rugby, which probably happened 10 times because it was always very cold. And I recently upgraded the TV end of last year. And what happens? I don't need the decoder anymore because you can run DSTV on an app.
Absolutely. Smart TVs. Television. Absolutely. So you no longer need the app provided.
But
you've got enough broadband. And you don't have to rewind.
Absolutely. You can't rewind. I mean, I'm one of those people who likes to go back and say, was it a try? Wasn't it a try? Anyway,
that's the downside.
I think it is an unbelievable situation where the television is being decoupled, firstly, from time So you can watch any episode at any time of the day if you want, using catch up or
you're telling me about the wonderful viewing options over to me, which is lovely, but we're talking about televisions and whether I'm a cheapskate or my son is unreasonable, and we need to have this discussion, because here I am in a radio studio where there's a 43-inch flat screen TV. I can't tell you what the brand is. I can't see the brand because there's hardly any frame to it. The picture is fine. There is no need for me to see the pores in the man's skin, which is what freaks me out about your 8K resolution, 185,000, 75-inch Neo QLED screen. I mean, I don't want to know that the person has blackheads.
Well, I do have to say that in at least one of those statements, Bruce, you are correct. You are a cheapskate. but then again, your son is being unreasonable, as teenagers are. But you know, if you've bought a TV in the last 5 years, the technology has plateaued. It really has, and it's, you can get a smart TV that lets you play just about any app: Netflix, Showmax, Amazon Prime Video. All of these things are available as an app, but. You know, if you're like me and you need an excuse to upgrade and, you know, you're looking for it, then this is a very good option. I mean, there's a very good chance I shan't upgrade, being a global pandemic and all. But that's what this segment's all about. What is
our talk to me about size, because size does matter when it comes to televisions.
Exactly. I was going to say, this is what you say to your son. Get someone
sit
to talk about this in case you forget. So what you say is that it depends how far away from the television you are. That's the most important metric. So, and they're online. Stuff.co.za has a metric. I forget exactly, but you've got to be X number of meters from a 40-inch screen, a 55-inch screen, a 65-inch screen. So this is the optimal viewing distance. So what should inform your choice of size is not I want the biggest TV in the neighborhood. It should be, how far do I sit from that television? And that's where what your eyes can focus on. So, you know, having a gigantosaurus of a television in your lounge, and your lounge is only 2 meters wide, is pointless, because you will be looking at pores when you should be looking at the big picture.
You are going to fry your eyeballs as well. Pause. Very quickly, television sound is pretty awful, and you've got to pump it up quite high to hear a lot of the broadcasts, especially as you get older.
True. Here's the thing.
Does every TV need one of those sound bars?
Yes and no. I mean, personally, I think yes, because, you know, the thinness of the television, speakers actually have to have a little cavity for the sound to move in and make a sound. Televisions are too small, so the addition of a soundbar is a great idea. Samsung sells brilliant ones. But personally, I've fallen in love with Sonos's Arc. I had their previous model, the Beam. This one is just spectacular. I've lost count how many speakers it's got. I think 22 of them. But what it does have is some very clever settings. So, for instance, late at night, if there's a loud chase scene, or if there's the adverts come on and they're really loud, or there's lots of
That's
shooting.
That's 20,000 rand. That's 20,000 rand just to hear the damn TV. Can't the TV just come with a better speaker?
Of course it can, Bruce. Of course it can. But, you know, these are many or... Money is no object options, which you shouldn't show to your teenage son by any means.
And I'm going to stop you talking now, because you're going to cost me money. Toby Shapshak, thank you. The publisher of Stuff Magazine, fabulous insights into the world of televisions.
You're with Bruce Whitfield
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
This is The Money Show. I'm Bruce Whitfield. Welcome to The Money Show on this Monday night. The Money Show brought to you by Absa Trade Management Online. Now's the time to speak to Absa Corporate and Investment Banking about all your import and export finance needs. Absa is a registered FSP. Dr. Richard Friedland, standing by. We'll talk to Ayobonga Qawe this evening. He has written a brand new book. It's called The Economy on Your Doorstep. And Colin Coleman, former general manager of Goldman Sachs in South Africa, at 7:30. Other people's money. That is all coming up this evening on The Money Show.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Well, South Africa in the grips of a third wave of COVID-19. There was some hope that it wouldn't get as bad as it has, but we're nowhere near the peak, it would seem. Dr. Richard Friedland, who is the Group Chief Executive of Netcare, on the line to us from Johannesburg. How are you guys holding up, Richard?
Bruce, it's extremely tough at the moment, to be perfectly honest.
Okay, elaborate on extremely tough.
Well, I think we're in a massive surge, an unprecedented surge here in the Gauteng. We were always concerned at the start of the COVID pandemic that the most populous and the most densely populated by square meter or kilometer, whichever metric you use, being the Gauteng, would face a surge of this nature, and we are now seeing it. And until last week, we were all merrily going along with this view. Experts were informing us that, yes, there would be a wave, but it would be lower for longer. And that trend line was broken on Wednesday last week when we saw over 6,900 or 7,900 cases in one day, 1,000 more than the peak on the 8th of January this year. And those numbers have continued to steadily rise. We saw record numbers of 8,400 on Saturday, and on Sunday, 8,600. And I'm afraid that these are numbers demonstrating that absent a lockdown, a level 5 lockdown in the Gauteng, we may not see the end of the surge for some time to come.
And that's a big appeal. And I've seen David Makura, the Gauteng Premier, talking about higher levels of restraint on people's movements. I mean, because I was driving through an area today and I just looked around me and was stunned by the fact that people weren't wearing masks. There was this absolute ambivalence to basic protocols.
I think you only have to look at the Google Mobility Index weekly average, and this is produced, you can get it out there on the www.covid19sa.org website, and you will see that there are activity levels in grocery and pharmacy and retail and recreation that are higher than they were, certainly in grocery and pharmacy, before the initial lockdown in March of last year. And I think that we face a simple choice. If government isn't going to lock down the Gauteng, we have to self-regulate ourselves. I can't make that appeal more stronger.
I mean, talk to me about the sort of pressure that your hospitals are under in terms of the availability of beds, particularly when it comes to high care and in ICU.
Well, there are about 1,800 beds, critical care beds across the province, the Gauteng province specifically. We have, in the private sector, we have approximately 50% of them. And I can tell you that right across the board, across all private sector participants, there is an urgent demand for high care or critical care beds. And there is only a certain amount of ventilators and only a certain amount of resources and staff to provide that care. And, you know, we're dealing virtually with something that I would classify as a mass casualty situation. The difficulty or the difference in a mass casualty situation, Bruce, is that there's a train accident or a stadium collapses or there's crush injuries on a massive scale, and you deal with it over a couple of hours and it resolves. We're dealing with a mass casualty situation on an ongoing basis across the Gauteng since last week, at least on Wednesday, Thursday last week.
Why are we less prepared than perhaps we could have been? Is it because of the experts' forecast that it would be lower for longer?
No, we are actually incredibly well prepared.
Okay.
There are great learnings from the first and second wave, but the sheer numbers of a highly dense population and a significant population, of the numbers breaking a trend line, we are 30% higher than we were in the second wave, and there is no evidence that we're peaking yet. It's the sheer numbers that are overwhelming facilities at the moment. It's not that facilities, either in the public or private sector, are not prepared. We've done an enormous amount around oxygenation. Treatment protocols have improved, but there are a lot more people getting infected. Now, it may be that the winter climate, and this has been shown internationally, people can't socially distance, they're indoors, ventilation is poorer. But irrespective of how well-prepared facilities are at the moment, the sheer numbers may well overwhelm the system.
And it doesn't help that we've had such a delay to our vaccination programs either.
No, of course not. And, you know, one would have hoped by now we would have been ahead in terms of vaccination, but we're not. And one hopes that the other provinces that may experience a third wave, such as the Western Cape and the Eastern Cape, and then potentially KwaZulu-Natal, can at least get as many people vaccinated as possible. I think the Western Cape, according to our forecast, and again, take that with a pinch of salt because no one really knows, is probably 3 to 4 weeks away from where we are.
That is a terrifying prognosis for people in the Western Cape, because also in the Western Cape, one looks at behavior and, you know, I don't think the behavior patterns are that much better. You're calling for a hard lockdown. How long would a lockdown need to be, in your estimation, to bring this thing under control?
Well, we certainly need to be closing schools, and there's this mythology around the fact that schools aren't transmitters of the virus. They certainly are. And, you know, you only have to go back again to the lesson of the Spanish flu, influenza of 1918. The cities that were successful in completely containing the outbreak of influenza were the ones that closed down schools early, public gatherings, religious gatherings, and the cities. And we are seeing more and more schools being impacted. We know that government schools are only closing, I think it's the 9th of July, and we believe that schools need to be closed down. Yes, children themselves may not be that badly impacted by the illness, but they pass it on to parents, they pass it on to caregivers, they pass it on to grandparents, and we think that that's problematic.
Is there any prospect? I mean, is this a discussion that's being held at any sort of senior level, or is this simply an appeal from yourselves as frontline workers at the very edge of what is happening in this third wave?
Well, I don't think it's an appeal just from frontline workers. I think there are many organizations that are saying that we need a form of lockdown. If it's not lockdown that is regulated by government, then people need to self-regulate themselves. And to the point that you made whilst I was interrupting you, of driving through an area and seeing people not wearing masks. You know, I'm in our COVID units virtually on a daily basis visiting patients, and it is horrific. And come and interview a patient struggling to breathe or who's got an oxygen mask on or high-flow nasal oxygen. That novelty wears off within minutes. They've got to lie there for 24 hours a day, day in and day out. And it's an agonizing disease.
And we're hearing so many horror stories. I mean, I don't know if it's possible at this stage. I mean, we're seeing a rise in cases in other parts of the world, the so-called Delta variant, or to regionalize it, the variant that originated in India, which seems to be, even in well-vaccinated societies, be causing higher levels of infection, the UK most notably. This Delta variant, do we know which variant is on the loose at present that is causing this particularly worse outbreak than we anticipated?
Well, Bruce, the experts are telling us that it's not the Delta variant and it's not the Alpha variant, but it's the same variant called the Beta variant that we saw in the second wave. The serotyping that we've done tends to confirm that. We think that you know, there were a lot less people affected in the Gauteng during the second wave. And so the herd immunity, or the amount of people that are immune, naturally immune within the Gauteng is less. But there's no evidence at the moment from experts that is suggesting there's another variant at play here.
Which is encouraging from the point of view of vaccine efficacy. If we could just get the vaccines in people's arms, sooner rather than later, we run the opportunity of stemming this thing.
I think you've hit the nail on the head, Bruce, is that the single most important initiative in our country, the single most important humanitarian initiative, is to vaccinate as many people as possible to achieve herd immunity. And absent that, there is no magic formula to stop the scourge of coronavirus.
Dr. Richard Friedland, Chief Executive at Netcare this evening, fraught. You can hear it in his voice. 30% higher so far in cases of infection, certainly in Gauteng, Western Cape, 3 to 4 weeks away from where Gauteng is at the moment. That's terrifying. What's happened to the temporary hospitals that were set up and then closed down at the end of the first wave? I wonder what the possibility is of re-engaging with those. It certainly seems they're going to be required, and the people needed also, of course, to staff those. We can avoid it. We can avoid the very worst outcomes by being smarter, by keeping our distance, by just avoiding crowds, by avoiding those social interactions. I know it's frustrating. My goodness me, I know it's frustrating. We're all fed up. But that's precise. The virus doesn't care about your emotions. The virus doesn't care that you're bored. The virus doesn't care that you're fed up and you want to go and visit granny. The risk of visiting granny now is that you kill granny. That's the brutal reality.
The Money Show.
Business books.
Tonight's book is by Ayawonga Kawe, who is a development economist. He is a broadcaster. He is an activist when it comes to the world of economic transformation. And one of the biggest and fastest developing crises in our time is inequality. Melinda Gates recently, I saw quoted, pointing out the fact that COVID-19 has worsened the crisis that was already untenable and obvious when you look locally by simply observing what is happening around you, the rise in homelessness and desperation of people keen to work but unable to find opportunities. And over the past year, average household wealth in South Africa rose 4%. Yes, we all, on average, got richer. Yet unemployment, especially amongst younger people, skyrocketed to its highest levels ever. And it's very clear that those with greater wealth have, on average, seen that increase, and those without have become a lot poorer. Ayabonga Traoré has tackled this in his book, The Economy on Your Doorstep. Why is it, Ayabonga, that we are incapable of bridging this enormous divide?
Good evening, Bruce, and good evening to the listeners of The Money Show. Thank you so much for having me on the show. Well, I think, Bruce, a big part of that answer has to do with allocative decisions of capital. They also have to do with what some people would argue is the experience in South Africa of primitive accumulation, of accumulation by dispossession, and the violence in that. I mean, if you think about how South Africa, as a sort of seen by many as a middle-income country, scores poorly on inequality, scores poorly on employment, worse than even poorer countries. And a lot of that has to do with, I guess, what has happened, to the African household, what has happened, to Black communities, and very particular and specific experiences in the late 19th century and the 20th century of a project of accumulation by dispossessing a large part of your population. And so I guess in the post-apartheid period, even though we've seen a wealth rising for many of those who own financial assets, what we certainly haven't seen is, you know, this large market capitalization on the JSE translating into real outcomes in the real economy. And a lot of that, I say in the book, has to do with the nature and the very specific nature of financialization in the South African economy. That certainly has a massive opportunity cost for real economy investment that sinks shafts, you know, that sets up factories, and that really, I guess, puts people to work.
And that's the, I mean, when one looks at the JSE on the day that Nelson Mandela was released from prison on in February 1990, 33 out of the top 40 companies on the JSE were mining companies. And that was because gold was in its heyday, and mines created hundreds of thousands of jobs. And over that time, I think only Anglo-American is now in the top 40. I've lost track of my own data on this, but the vast majority of companies in the top 40 of the JSE are services businesses. There's some retailers in there, but there's some banks. And yeah, the banks employ 40 and 50,000 people each, and the retailers employ 40, 50,000 people, and Bidvest employs 130,000 people. But unfortunately, we need more than 40 companies doing precisely that, because that's not nearly enough to begin to chip away at this huge mountain of poverty that we have in our country. And that is your appeal then for real jobs for real people, not the jobs we need, not necessarily the jobs we want, perhaps.
Well, I guess, you know, Bruce, when you paint the picture in that kind of way, what I guess makes it a bit worse is that it's quite akin to having your feet in some quicksand and sinking in very, very quickly. Because if you think about, you know, some of the entities you've mentioned, in particular the banks, and where they make their money, one of the things I argue in the book is that if you look at their books over a very consistent period of time, more than 40% of that money has been what would be seen as sort of a non-interest income. So incomes that aren't directly associated with the theoretical function of banks as people who take from depositors and lend to others and make the spread in the middle. But what you, in effect, you're seeing, and this is not unique to South Africa, but I guess quite clear in many financialized economies, is an accumulation model that is able to be quite profitable without the need for warm human bodies. And if you look, for instance, at the key drivers in the current moment of some of the non-interest income, aside from just banking fees, it's all manner of types of fees that are not necessarily associated with lending outcomes to the real economy or directly to households. But a lot of it has to do with, commissions, revenues from trading activity, revenues from real estate investment, and many other issues. So I guess that's the reality that we face. And so, in an economy like that,
and it's the crisis
reliant on labor. You know?
I know you have a deadline and a pressing deadline.
Sure.
It's the crisis of hope and the crisis of opportunity. I was very fortunate to spend some time this morning with Professor Jonathan Janssen, who's taught in the United States in Stanford, and to a school there, and in schools in the Cape Flats. And he passionately believes that in terms of ability, the kids he's taught in the Cape Flats versus the kids that he's taught in Stanford, there's no difference between the aptitude, the ability of these kids. It is the lack of access to opportunity to make the best of themselves, which is so sorely missing in South Africa. Would you concur?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, that's a continuous factor in the political economy and history of South Africa, Bruce, because if you think about, I mean, the early claims during the Great Depression, which is a period I look at in the book, and take a lot from the Native Economic Commission that happened in the 30s, that was able to visit parts of the Eastern Cape, Mthatha, Cathcart, you know, Queenstown, where I'm from. And one of the big things that a lot of the African leaders at the time were raising was that you're levying poll taxes on people, you're levying all manner of fiscal instruments, irrespective of the ability of people to pay. But one of the real horrific measures that came with apartheid was that you were levying taxes, but you weren't really investing in social reproductive activity that improves the life chances of many young people born in some of the places I speak about in the book. And so in a sense, you know, you have the stunting, you have the weak educational outcomes, and in a way the cards are stacked in very adverse ways for many of those people as they enter into the labor market, which I guess continues to be a very alienating experience. And I do think that, you know, one of the key and the crux of the issue here, Bruce, is that we need to think very intentionally in this country about what type of asset transfer we think about. And indeed, we need a land reform program and we need it rather urgently. But some of the other things that we need are really about making significant social investments into the communities where people live to make those livable places to not only just live, but to produce and to also play as well. Because if we don't resolve that crisis, then I argue in the book that that's what accounts for why the South African economy continues to misfire and potentially, and I guess ostensibly, will account for why it will continue to do so.
You have a deadline. You need to go. I am Mboko Traore. Thank you very much indeed. The book is The Economy on Your Doorstep. And I did some research into this for my own book. And he talks about stunting, and he talks about you come from a community where there is not enough food on the table, where you are, your brain at its most vulnerable stage of development can't develop because it's not nourished. And then you go into school and you're hungry and you can't concentrate. You are so disadvantaged from the start. And I just look at the failings of the education system up until 1994, and I look at the failings of the education system since 1994. And next week, the book that we're going to be reviewing is by somebody I grew up admiring hugely from the small town I grew up in. Her name is Jane Evans, and she started a program called Ndadaise. And it's going to feed so nicely into that particular book, A Path Unexpected. She was the women's editor at the Rand Daily Mail, and she met a farmer, a wealthy farmer with beautiful calves. She says so in the book, in the fields as well as on his legs. And Jane moves to the Free State and is completely horrified by the fact that she needs a purpose. And she discovers her purpose in creating not only a nursery school on the farm where she lives and has her family, but she develops this extraordinary network, of early childhood development centers, which to this day continues to make a huge impact on young people's lives, because it is so absolutely pivotal to get that grounding right, not only from an education perspective, but from a nutrition perspective. And so much that has to be done. But Ayabonga Tawe, thank you very much for coming through for us this evening. His book is The Economy on Your Doorstep, and it explores in a great deal of detail the huge chasm of inequality in South Africa.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, brought to you by Absa Trade Management Online. Transact securely online with Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Absa is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Other people's money.
Well, tonight's Other People's Money guest has been a very, very active voice alongside the likes of the late Jabu Mabuza and the pushback against state capture before we even fully understood what was at play in terms of state capture. We knew something was rotten. We just didn't know the full extent of it. And we probably still don't know, frankly, the full extent of it. We're getting a good idea through the Zondo Commission, and we're getting a good idea through the books and the testimonies that are being playing out each and every single day. But the former general manager of Goldman Sachs in South Africa, now senior fellow and lecturer at the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University, is Colin Coleman. And I saw the remarks you made last week that reflected the very real pain that you've been feeling following the death of Jabu Mabuza. Colin Coleman, welcome to The Money Show. And it's been an extraordinarily, I think, tumultuous time in all of our lives, but you're taking it, you know, you're feeling this very, very personally.
Hi, Bruce. Yeah, thanks for having me on the show. It's sort of the best of times and the worst of times. Just today, you know, we had a memorial service for Jabu, and the best of times, my father, Max Coleman, turned 95, and I'm here.
I saw you posting a picture on Instagram with a picture of your dad, and he doesn't look 95, not a day over 85, if that. I mean, he looks in fine fettle.
That's absolutely remarkable. He's had an incredible life, and just so... We in South Africa are just so grateful that he's still with us. And he was a parliamentarian. He was a businessman, a doctorate in chemical engineering. He took up scuba diving when he was 50. And he posted his 1400th dive on his 90th birthday with his grandchildren. He's a remarkable person to have as a father.
He was in Nelson Mandela's cabinet, right? I mean, what got him into ANC politics? You were an activist in your time, and you were instrumental in linking and liaising between business and the ANC back in those days. What was his role?
So, you know, this 1981, my elder brother, was detained by the security police in September 1981. At the time when a number of South African activists were detained in what the police felt to be a conspiracy linked to Barbara Hogan's list of activists working for the ANC. And my brother was in detention for 5 months, and next to Neil Agut, who, as you know, died in detention, the subject of which is under investigation whether he did in fact commit suicide or his suicide was induced. But he was certainly tortured. I think that's a matter of record. And in that time, my parents became instantly involved in forming the Detainees Parent Support Committee with a whole bunch of other activists' parents. And, you know, for the next effectively 13 years up until 1994, were active in human rights organizations, effectively assisting the plight of detainees. And if you see the messages to my father tonight from people like Paul Mashatile and a variety of activists, Murphy Morobe phoned him, you know, just the number of people who see my parents as their parents because they really got behind it together with the likes of the Kachalia parents and others. They got behind, effectively the detainees who were really at the mercy of the security police at the time under the Terrorism Act of those times. So, you know, that's what brought them into the struggle, but they followed it, and my family became very involved. My father then became a parliamentarian in the first Mandela government. What's not well known is I was actually on the list as well, but withdrew my name because I was involved in nonpartisan negotiation facilitations up until, you know, the elections in 94. And my mom was in the Gauteng legislature for a number of years. So my father and mom really had a very interesting role in the transition process, and are very grateful for their experience.
Are you glad you didn't get into politics in that way, in terms of going and taking up a seat in Parliament?
Well, you know, I'm glad that I stayed, in the sense I managed to play a quite, I think, important role in cementing a peaceful election, because and if I'd accepted being in Parliament, I would have had to resign from the role I was playing in the negotiations. And I'm not sure that we would have had, frankly, the same result, because what I was able to do was link up with a variety of people to get Buthelezi and Nkata into the elections at the last minute. And that was obviously a very important role. And more broadly, if I'd gone into Parliament, I would have been 31. And, you know, my view at the time was that it was really now black leadership that was needed in Parliament under Mandela's government. And it's, you know, was my thought then, still to be tested now, that, you know, 25 years later, which is really where we are, that, you know, people would play their role based on merit, not on the basis of, you know, affirmative action or called it racial, on a racial basis. So, you know, I think now is the time where 25 years later, we're getting to see that, you know, what we need is we need the best skills and the best expertise to lean into the problems that South Africa has, and we have so many.
If you were approached again, would you do it this time?
I'm not sure that we really are the... Excuse me?
If you were approached again, would you do it this time?
So I think, you know, I'm in a different phase of my life now where I can enter into public service. And I, you know, if I was approached for the right role and I had the authority to do what I was being asked to do, and I now have the skills, I have financial independence, I would certainly serve the country in whatever way the country wanted me to do. But it would have to be something, you know, that was, you know, a significant...
Parliament wouldn't necessarily be your first choice. I mean, a lot of people, very, you know, strong personalities in Parliament, get very frustrated by the horse trading and the bureaucracy and the party politics of it all. I mean, I think that's that much is clear. You see yourself in a more sort of a fixer-upper role for the country as a whole.
Yeah, Bruce, I think what I'm trained for now after 25 years in banking is to have, you know, to play a role in the executive in getting things done. So, you know, whether it's, you know, in transacting, and this, you know, the South African Airways is a very good example of something that's provided, or, you know, is provided a sense that we can actually fix our problems. But there's so many other problems to fix in South Africa, starting with the unemployment problem, the public service problem, the economy, the balances in our society, or the imbalances in our society. So there's so much that one can do. So certainly I think the legislature is a very important policy framework to get right, but it's not so much a policy problem we have as an execution problem, implementation problem. And so that's where I think my skills are best served. But, you know, you serve a country when you're asked to serve. I've got lots going on. I'm busy on very many fronts, but I would certainly respond to something that was meaningful.
You were very outspoken in your role and very supportive of the transition from Jacob Zuma after Nhlanhla Nene and you and Jabu and others stepped up to the plate, and to really, I think, came under a huge amount of personal stress at the time, because, you know, there was a huge pushback against sort of the business's resistance to Jacob Zuma and the lunacy of that time. Are you still involved sort of in that sort of fixing space, or are you more private sector focused now with Yale and other issues?
Well, I'm actually completed my Yale stint and I'm back in South Africa full time. But, you know, at that time that we were dealing with Jabu, who played such an instrumental role, I remember sitting with him. He asked me to sit next to him when he was delivering the message on behalf of business with Jacob Zuma literally 2 feet away from us. And he basically said, you know, that the Gupta and Zuma family's activities were unacceptable straight to the president's face, who actually, I think, responded in a very calm way, because, you know, many presidents wouldn't take that. But we had significant pressures, but it was absolutely critical we did that. In reality, you know, we used to say as business to investors, you know, that we have a very strong, resilient civil society, constitution, judiciary, the press, the role of the media being so active, the role of the business community being so active in labor and so on. But in reality, a lot more damage was done than even we knew at the time. And, you know, South Africa, you know, the Zuma era plus COVID now have really put the Ramaphosa administration under huge amounts of pressure. And he really needs all the help he can get from everyone, from business, from labor, and from government. And my personal point of view is that it's not just up to government to fix it. You know, we all in it. We all have to help, whether it's business, whether it's trade unions. So the trade unions have to deal with this public sector wage ballooning. Business has to deal with the fact that there is a huge amount of people who are unemployed. So the Youth Employment Service project is one small but important aspect of fixing it. But we really need to get growth going in the country in order to get employment. And generally, I think the government is going to have to do some quite unorthodox things, such as an unemployment grant, which I believe is absolutely necessary. It may or may not be a basic income grant, but we certainly are going to have to put more resources into the unemployed to stimulate the economy, to get people to work. Because if you have 11 million people who are unemployed and 15 million people employed, it is not a recipe for success. You have to get much more productivity from the society. And so I know we've talked about this, Bruce, for years, you and I on the show. But the situation is actually getting more serious and not improving. But COVID was unexpected. You know, you just have to rise to the challenge and deal with it. But I think we're going to have to do some of the things that other societies have done, including, you know, putting money to work, which will raise the debt. But if we don't raise the growth level of growth, then, you know, the debt to GDP ratio is going to go up as growth goes down. It's not just debt that goes up, the debt to GDP goes up. So,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, we have growth going in the society.
We most certainly do. We'll pause in just and come back in a second. I'm curious about you and your money, because 25 years in banking would have been lucrative. Dad has had a good career as well. So looking forward to chatting a little bit about money in a moment.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, brought to you by Absa Trade Management Online. Transact securely online with Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Absa is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Other people's money.
He holds a BA in architecture from Wits University, went into banking, and is willing to give time to help South Africa repair itself. Colin Common, are you in a position now where if you didn't work another day in your life in terms of receiving a salary, you'd be okay? So you're available for national duty on a no-fee basis?
Yeah, unequivocally, yes. I mean, it sounds easy to say, but I think the reality is that having spent 25 years in banking and benefited through that time, you know, that's wealth creation is not what drives me. It might happen, but it's not what drives me. And certainly, if I was in a government service role, I wouldn't want to take a salary.
It's the ability to do that and to have taken care of your money. I mean, did you do it all yourself? Did you outsource the process of, you know, I mean, earning a salary is one thing, even earning a great salary is one thing, but building capital and allowing that capital to grow takes an awful lot of energy and time. How did you do it?
Yeah, look, I think some, you know, different people make wealth happen in different ways. I'm actually quite conservative. And so what I've done throughout my time is I've obviously invested in physical assets, but I've saved along the way. And I've always believed, you know, in trying to accumulate enough savings that at some point I wouldn't have to work and I'd be able to pay for the education of my children. And I have, children who are going to international universities, which is very expensive. So, it's trying to work out what is the amount of saving one needs to have, and then also be able to live a certain lifestyle, so that you don't get yourself into problems in the future. So that I think, you know, at some point and a lot of people get this wrong, I've got to say. At some point, you've earned enough and you've got to live your life and you've got to give back to society and, you know, invest in making the world a better place. And, roughly when I retired from Goldman Sachs, I'd made that decision that I'd reached that point and, you know, the last third of my life, let's call it the next 20 years, is really about, you know, reinvesting in society, and that's what's driving me.
Do you have any bad personal habits? Do you have expensive habits? Very briefly, Jabu told us when we spoke to him about this that he loved fast cars and he loved nice houses and he had houses all over the place, and of course he had a penchant for hats as well. Do you have some similar sort of habits?
Jabu is such a character. I love him like a brother, and I'm going to miss him terribly. My habits, if I've got one indulgence, it's traveling. So I absolutely love traveling. I've been to New York twice this year. I've just taken my family to the Maldives. In order to get to New York, you have to be in other countries for 14 days outside of South Africa. So that's an expensive thing to do, and that's sort of my indulgence, but I love it. And, you know, it's about seeing the world, about and not letting things like COVID defeat you, you know, and people will be doing that in their own ways. And I say that knowing that there's just a huge amount of pain in the world, in South Africa at the moment. And, you know, every morning one wakes up to bad news. So I say that with a great amount of respect to the pain that's in society at the moment.
Colin Coleman, thank you very much for sharing with us this evening. Colin Coleman, up for national duty, if anybody's listening.